This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 2, The Resurrection, was in many ways his own resurrection, not because of the title, which he didn't give it, or the symphony's program, tracing the progression from death to eternal life, which he acknowledged but never specifically spelled out. Mahler's first symphony, which had its premiere some 5 years before the second, had been roundly booed at its first performances. Even Mahler's future wife, Alma Schindler, walked out in disgust. Mahler always said this was the reason he was never fully accepted as a composer, although he also famously said, "My time will come." In 1888, Mahler had begun working on a composition he called Totenfeier, or Funeral Rites. He had been thinking about a piece like this for some time, but the actual composition was set in motion by two events. He had been asked by the grandson of Carl Maria von Weber to complete one of Weber's unfinished operas, and after the successful premiere, Mahler spent the evening lying in bed surrounded by flowers and imagining himself at his own funeral. He had also just broken off a love affair with von Weber's wife. Mahler threw himself into his own composition, and by the time he had finished it, he realized that Totenfeier should be not an independent piece, but the first movement of a symphony. So, whenever his conducting schedule would permit, he worked on filling out what would become his Symphony No. 2, which he finished in 1894. Every so often, Mahler would talk about the symphony's program, but he would add, "It gives only a superficial indication, all that any program can do for a musical work, let alone this one, which is so much all of a piece that it can no more be explained than the world itself." So it's not surprising that he changed his mind several times about what the program actually was. What all his versions have in common, though, is that the Totenfeier remains intact, as a requiem for a dead hero, specifically the hero of the first symphony. The second and third movements represent retrospect, the former being innocent and nostalgic, the latter including a certain element of the grotesque. The fourth and fifth movements are the resolution, and they deal with the last judgment, redemption, and resurrection. The first and last movements are the biggest, but they are completely different in character, in part because Mahler wrote them 6 years apart, but also because of their different structural and expressive functions. The opening Totenfeier is clearly a funeral march, but it is structured in the classical sonata form that Mozart and Haydn perfected. Mahler's choice of the key of C minor is also a look backward. It's a tribute to the funeral march in Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the archetypal symphonic funeral march. The movement is also full of fits and starts and almost violent shifts of mood, a dramatic feature that Mahler practically invented. The high drama begins at the opening, with violins and violas scrubbing away, while the low strings hurl turns, scales, and broken chords at them. The instruction in the score is to play ferociously. But at the same time, Mahler has written two distinct speeds for these string figures and the rests that separate them, the former in violent onslaught, the latter in the movement's main tempo. The second theme is also a tribute to Beethoven, in this case, his violin concerto. Later on, the development section climaxes in a crash of dissonance, followed by a series of pauses and a serenely beautiful coda, interrupted by a sudden mad rush to the end. Mahler had specified a pause of at least 5 minutes after the end of the first movement as a chance to gather one's thoughts, because the second movement has the effect after the first not of contrast, but as a mere irrelevance. This is my fault and not to be blamed on insufficient comprehension on the part of listeners. The Andante was composed as a kind of intermezzo, like some lingering resonance of long past days from the life of him whom we bore to his grave in the first movement, something from the days when the sun still smiled upon him. End quote. This movement was occasionally played on its own as a concert piece, like the minuet from the Third Symphony. Mahler used to refer to these pastoral pieces as the raisins in his cakes. The movement begins with a Ländler, an Austrian folk song like the ones Mahler heard growing up, and which he would use again and again in his symphonies. This dance, and the melodies that follow, were some of the first music Mahler wrote for the symphony, dating back to his original sketches in the 1880s. Not everyone enjoyed these interludes, though. During a performance in Paris in 1910, Claude Debussy, Paul Dukas, and Gabriel Pierney all walked out. Reactionary, they said, and too much like Schubert. The third movement is a symphonic expansion of Mahler's song about St. Anthony of Padua's Sermon to the Fishes from his collection Des Knaben Wunderhorn, or The Youth's Magic Horn. Scherzo is Italian for joke, and Mahler's scherzos are where he let loose his sardonic sense of humor. This Fischbredicht scherzo finally skids into silence, and its final shudder is succeeded by a new sound. The sound of the human voice. This is Urlicht, primal light, a song that Mahler wrote after most of this symphony was already completed and inserted as the fourth movement. Mahler at one point said that the first three movements of the symphony were only an exposition and that Urlicht sheds light on what comes before. The mezzo-soprano sings, "Dear God, will give me a little light, will light me to eternal blissful life." But then, the peace of Urlicht is shattered with an outburst that recalls the finale of Beethoven's Ninth. Like Beethoven, Mahler draws on music from earlier in the symphony, not, however, to reject it, but to build upon it. Horns, which Mahler referred to as the criers in the wilderness, sound in the distance, followed by a march with a suggestion of the Gregorian Dies Irae, music saturated in angst, more trumpet signals, marches, and a chorale. Then comes Mahler's great summons, the last trump. Horns and trumpets loud but at a great distance, while in the foreground, a solitary bird flutters across the scene of destruction, and out of the silence, voices emerge in a hymn of resurrection. Mahler knew early on that he wanted a vocal finale to his symphony, but he had a difficult time finding the right text. He finally found it in a resurrection hymn by the 18th century Saxon poet Friedrich Gottlieb Klopstock, which was sung at the funeral of Mahler's good friend and supporter, conductor and pianist Hans von Bülow. Mahler took the first two stanzas of Klopstock's hymn and added verses of his own that deal still more explicitly with redemption and resurrection. Lines about vanquishing pain and death are given to the two soloists in a passionate duet. Verses beginning, "With wings that I have won," lead to the triumphant reappearance of the chorale, "I will die that I might live." And the symphony closes in fanfares and pealing bells. If the premiere had been anything less than a triumph, it might have meant the end of Mahler's career, if not his life. It had all the hallmarks of a disaster. In order to finance the concert, he had to use his own funds and borrow money from friends, and he still had to paper the house with musicians and students from the Berlin Conservatory. Some critics refused to attend the performance, and to top it all off, on the day of the concert, Mahler was struck down by a massive migraine. Nevertheless, he dragged himself to the podium and forced himself to conduct. After the performance, he collapsed in his dressing room. Thank you. it was worth it. Mahler's Resurrection Symphony was his most popular and successful work during his lifetime, and one of the most profound and moving musical statements ever made. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.